from San Francisco. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Today we're featuring interviews from our archives. When engineers fix a machine, they'll say, "There's no technology like old technology." And historians will tell you, "If you don't study history, you're doomed to repeat it." Today we're combining these two perspectives. We're going to look at some early technologies that were important to both a great American city and a great American composer. Los Angeles is considered to be the first modern American city. It's modern because its first great boom days were in the 1920s, when the burgeoning film industry and the multitude of oil wells fueled the economy. At the same time, outrageous promises were made to investors through the newly minted technology of the tabloid, and a wide audience could be affected by the first ever radio evangelists. And these were all means of communication not possible before. Today I'll speak with Jules Tigel, a professor of history at San Francisco State. He recounts courtroom murders, shady characters, bigger-than-life pillars of the community, and a Shanghai suicide. Without technology, Los Angeles might have been just another sleepy little town. Then we'll turn to the world of entertainment. Artist Wodehouse is a pianist and a Gershwin scholar. The National Endowment for the Humanities initially funded her study of the early player piano roles of composer George Gershwin. She'll tell us about the fascinating process of converting these roles to the technology of today. And she brought her own high-tech piano so we can actually hear George Gershwin play his music live for us today as he played it decades ago. In The Great Los Angeles Swindle, Professor Jules Tigel recounts the dramatic scandal surrounding Julian Petroleum. I asked him to paint a picture of Los Angeles in the 1920s.
Well, Los Angeles had already emerged as a fairly large city at the dawn of the 1920s. In the county itself, there were probably about 1 million people. But in the aftermath of World War I, the city boomed on an unprecedented level. A number of things fueled the boom. Hollywood, of course, was flourishing, tremendous real estate boom. Agriculture and banking were developing. But most important was oil. There were three massive oil strikes right on the outskirts of the city, one in Long Beach, one in Huntington Beach, and one at Santa Fe Springs. And never before had there been major mineral strikes like this within a half an hour's drive of a major American city. And this created a tremendous sensation, which helped to fuel this boom. And within a few years, the city was pushing about 2 million people and had become a major American metropolis.
Looking at the picture on the cover of your book, we see these wooden oil wells, the oil drilling apparatus sort of going out into the horizon. What did that look like?
If you went to Signal Hill, which was the big field just outside of Long Beach, the whole hill was just covered with oil derricks. And prior to the Los Angeles oil boom, the usual rule of thumb was you would have one derrick for every 5 acres. In Los Angeles, the derricks could be a few hundred yards, even 50 yards apart. Sometimes they ended up pumping each other's oil. So it was a very tight congestion, in part because this land had already been subdivided. Often oil was discovered on these vast plains in the public domain or where one owner owned all the land. In Los Angeles, where subdivision was sort of the national pastime in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the people who wanted to develop this oil had to deal with a lot of small landowners. And so there was lots of opportunity for not only large companies, but for small independent people to come in and drill their wells.
Now, against this backdrop, tell us about the Julian Petroleum swindle.
Well, it operates on several levels, and it begins with C.C. Julian, who was a master promoter, mainly from newspaper advertising. And he was an independent operator who secured a lease at Santa Fe Springs, which was the biggest of the three fields, and drilled three wells there, promising to make his investors rich. And lo and behold, all three of those wells, and then two more he drilled, all hit oil. And he became sort of the crown prince of the oil promoters. And he decided to move on from there to create a company which he claimed would rival Standard Oil, called the Julian Petroleum Corporation. And Julian himself was one of the most well-known and colorful figures in Los Angeles in the 1920s. He was flamboyant. He had always accompanied by actresses and hopping around nightclubs and driving around in fancy cars. He was a wonderful dresser, as you can see from his pictures in the book. And the Julian Petroleum Company attracted about 30,000 to 40,000 investors, many of whom just invested their life savings thinking that Julian was going to make them rich. But there was a good deal of suspicion very early on that Julian was not all that he claimed to be. And he was ultimately driven out of his company by a combination of investigations by state authorities, federal authorities, and he turned the company over to S.C. Lewis, who, with his associate Jacob Berman, really began to use the company as the basis for a very wild pyramiding of stock overissues, loans, investment pools, which vastly overissued the stock and led to the collapse of the company.
But in this book, there are murders and suicides and con artists. And I mean, it just goes on. And there are small guys who are just little investors. And things happen to them. And politicians get involved.
Right. And some very prominent names invested in the company. Cecil B. DeMille was an investor. Louis B. Mayer was a member of the so-called million-dollar pool, along with people like Harry Haldeman, who was the grandfather of H.R. Haldeman of Watergate fame. The story involves people. T.C. Julian has a wonderful fistfight with Charlie Chaplin at the Cafe Petrushka, with Yasha Heifetz and Mary Miles Minter and many other celebrities sitting on. And of course, many of Los Angeles's top politicians, underworld figures, people like Charlie Crawford, who is known as the Gray Wolf of the underworld, Robert Shuler, the one of the first radio evangelists, is very heavily involved in the exposés of the scandal. So this scandal itself really cut across many levels of Los Angeles history, carried over into state and national politics.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I don't know what it would be. How big was this scandal at the time?
Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's probably at least an 8 or a 9, and in terms of its complexities and the wonderful twists and turns it takes, I would say it's probably a 12. But I think we have to realize that the figures given usually is that this was a $150 million scandal. If we translate that into modern terms, we're talking about a multi-billion dollar scandal. So it would be comparable to much of the savings, many of the savings and loans, individual savings and loan scandals. It's the type of scandal that if it had happened in New York on the New York Stock Exchange would be part of the national folklore. But because it was hidden away in California and hidden away in Los Angeles, which very few people paid attention to in the 1920s, and which much of our national history and folklore still ignores, it's largely been forgotten.
My guest today is Jules Teigl. He's a professor at San Francisco State University in history, and his latest book is The Great Los Angeles Swindle. You know, I'm fascinated by how Los Angeles at this moment in time was transformed because you were able to find oil and profitable kinds of things and drill for it. I mean, movie making, without technology, there would be no industry. And it's as if this was a sleepy little town with orchards for years and years and years. And suddenly, new industries came in and changed the whole fabric of the society.
It would be a mistake to see L.A. by 1920 as a sleepy little town. What's unusual, beginning in the 1880s, Los Angeles had become one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. What was unusual about its growth between 1880 and 1920 is that it was in many ways the first modern city, the first city based on things like service and tourism. In essence, Los Angeles was growing on growth itself. There were so many people, the Chamber of Commerce had launched massive advertising campaigns to encourage people to come and settle in Los Angeles, to encourage tourists, tourism was just beginning in the late 19th century. We were just beginning to have a middle class which had the money, which had the time to take a few weeks off for vacation. In fact, prior to the 1920s, it was primarily a winter haven. People would be escaping the cold Midwest and come in the winter. Beginning in the 1920s, they formed the All-Year Club, which promoted it as an all-year tourist attraction. At about the same time, we're beginning to see people who are getting paid vacations in the summers. So prior to the 1920s, Los Angeles is growing rapidly, but it's growing without a real industrial base. Beginning with World War I and the early 1920s, several industries begin to emerge. And, for example, the shipping industry, the port of Los Angeles. Los Angeles didn't really have a port prior to the early 20th century when they built a man-made port at San Pedro. By the end of the 1920s, San Pedro had outstripped San Francisco as the leading port on the West Coast.
Everybody knows the movie Chinatown. I mean, we're all familiar with it. Is this another kind of Chinatown?
It's a Chinatown in oil, in that Chinatown, of course, deals with the water wars in Los Angeles, with the controversy surrounding the development of the Owens Valley project. Though it's very loosely based on that. They moved the events about 20 years later. But this is the same era that the movie Chinatown takes place in. And in many ways, shows of Los Angeles very similar to what Chinatown shows, with a very dark underside, a city that is growing rapidly, perhaps too rapidly for its own social good, and one in which the infrastructure can't quite hold the tremendous economic, technological, cultural energies that are unleashed by the hundreds of thousands of people just flooding into Los Angeles looking for opportunity.
Very early on in the book, it was talking about how Motley Flint started very early financing the films. And he was saying to very important people that we would recognize, I don't care. I know you're going down the right alley. I know you're doing this and you're doing that. And they invested in the talking pictures. It doesn't strike me as strange to have some of those big names and then have Motley go up to him and say, hey, could you put a dime over here?
Sure, and he organized the million-dollar pool and brought in people like Louis B. Mayer. And this is, of course, part of the Los Angeles business elite and the way many of the companies operated. You have interlocking boards of directors. You have a business elite which meets for lunches at the California Club. And when they hear that there's an investment which can yield them a quick profit, many of the people are willing to put some money in there, some not even thinking about it, but some thinking very, very clearly and willing to take the risks. And somebody like Motley Flint, who is one of the giants of early financing of the film industry, really is ruined in many ways by his involvement with the Julian Petroleum scandal, and in the end is assassinated in a courtroom assassination because of his role in the Julian scandal.
Well, I think my point is that when money is flowing many different ways, I'm giving you big loans over here and I know we're all making money out of it, then when I ask you to kind of pitch in over here and get involved, well, then you're going to. It's all kind of, this is good business. And then that enables that person to turn around and say, well, Louis B. Mayer, he just put in this many $1,000s, and you're a little guy, so why don't you step up to the line? And even if it's not that central figure, I've seen many times how one person brings a name in, and then another person, a little shady, brings somebody else in. And pretty soon there's this whole web of a bunch of people being involved, and nobody really knows what's going on.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And the other thing to remember is the tremendous speculative mentality that existed in the 1920s, not just in Los Angeles, where it was truly at fever pitch, but throughout the nation. I think it's a mistake to see this whole episode as a Los Angeles story, even though it takes place in Los Angeles. Remember, the 1920s is characterized by events like the Florida land boom. There's all sorts of mining swindles. There are other oil swindles. Teapot Dome in the 1920s. There is, of course, the tremendous bull market on Wall Street. This often happens at a time when the economy is expanding rapidly, is creating many legitimate opportunities. And it becomes very difficult for people to distinguish between the legitimate business opportunities and those which are purely speculative. And, of course, you can, if you play your cards right, do very well in a purely speculative venture as long as you get out before everybody else before the venture collapses. And in the Julian swindle, many of the biggest investors, the members of the million-dollar pool, pulled out and took their profits. Their profits amounted to something like a 78% profit in about six months of investment. And then when the company collapsed, it was the tens of thousands of small investors who lost their savings.
Just really quickly, some people don't understand, why is a stock overissue bad? What does it do? And is it always doomed? Is it always a bad idea?
It's usually a bad idea. It depends on the level of the overissue, of course. Stocks are issued usually based in relationship to the prospects for the company. Stocks are issued in order to provide funding for the company to grow and to build. And there are two ways to make money. One is if the stock goes up. But the other thing, of course, if you put out more stocks than you're authorized to, or more stocks than is merited, you can just make money selling those stocks. You can use the paralleling of the classic movie, the Mel Brooks' movie, The Producer, when you know what he decides the way to make money in The Producers is to take a play, the worst possible play, and instead of making a hit out of it, oversubscribing it. And so he makes a musical comedy called Springtime for Hitler oversubscribes it by 1,000% and, of course, gets into trouble when it becomes a smash hit. The same thing happens in the Los Angeles oil boom and in the Julian swindle. The Julian Petroleum Company was authorized to sell about 360,000 shares of stock. Instead, they sold about 5 million shares of stock. So we're not talking here about a minor overissue. We're talking about a massive overissue. A company which was supposedly worth $30 million was actually worth probably about $8 million, sold stock for $150 million. So in that case, of course, an overissue can never be good.
Who got the money?
We don't know entirely. Certainly stockbrokers made lots of money. In many ways, they are the big villains here because they had to know from their own records the stock was overissued. They collected commissions on all the stock they sold. They also manipulated, bulled, and bared the stock on the Los Angeles Stock Exchange to their advantage. Many of the investors who did get out in time, many of the people who engaged in the pools, in the million-dollar pool, in the so-called Tijuana pool, there was a San Francisco pool which involved Senator Hiram Johnson's son, Archie. Lewis was very good at bringing in well-connected, well-known people. Certainly Lewis and Berman made off with millions of dollars, although Lewis always claimed he didn't, and we've never found his money. Berman, it was very clear, had several $1 million stashed away after he got out of prison.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jules Tigel. He's a professor of history at San Francisco State University. You may remember his last book, Baseball's Great Experiment, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. I have to say that this, to me, was not a history book. It was so full of life, and the people are so lively. Where did I go wrong? Should I have been a history major? Are they all like this? And I was looking
They're
at
the computer. They're not all like this, but quite a number of them are. I think that what attracted me to this story, I first discovered it in a very small synopsis in Carrie McWilliams' classic book, Southern California, An Island on the Land. And I said, that's a nice story. It probably will take me a few years to piece together and has interesting characters. And it ended up taking me about 10 years to piece together the swindle. And it just took more twists and turns than just when I thought the story was over, just when I thought I had everything down, there'd be a new twist, a new turn, and the story would just emerge again in the most unexpected fashions.
Well, what were you looking at? How did you find your information that would lead you to new information about the story?
Well, one of the interesting sources that I used were newspaper ads, because both C.C. Julian and later S.C. Lewis sold their stock by advertising in the newspapers. And one of the really important developments of the 1920s was the tremendous expansion of mass marketing and mass advertising. And Julian really was able to tap into that. And so his ads, which were very verbose, often very clever, playing on the speculative desires of people, really also contained a lot of information about his battles with the corporation commissioner, with federal officials, about the state of the company, and S.C. Lewis's ads as well. So he did a lot of research looking through hundreds of newspaper advertisements. There were, needless to say, court records, since there were many, many, many trials coming out of this, newspaper accounts, receivership records, since the company did end up in receivership. And all of these provided quite a lot more than I ever anticipated I'd be able to find.
When I think about stock being sold to you by these sort of personal pleas and ads, I'm always reminded about how information gets to people. And there's a whole big change going on about this time, isn't there?
There's really a tidal shift in the 1920s. I think we would recognize the world of the 1920s more than we would the world before World War I. One of the things that happens is people begin to absorb information, absorb knowledge in a very different way. Prior to this time, it was a much more literary, much more verbal world. Now it became a more visual world. Tabloid newspapers begin right in 1920. Of course, the spread of not just movies, but newsreels. This became photographs. People could actually see these people. People could see pictures of C.C. Julian. People could see, one of the reasons that Lindbergh was such a phenomenon is that you could vicariously be there yourself in the newsreel, watch him take off, watch him land. This wasn't possible for prior generations. By the mid-20s, radio had also revolutionized the way that we absorb knowledge. And we began to see the emergence of a mass market. And what we're seeing here, in a sense, is the discovery also of mass psychology. And advertisers are beginning to, through more visual ads, through ads that are designed much more specifically to go after people and go after their weaknesses. And, you know, industries are forming industrial psychology. Advertising companies are forming, are looking more into the psychology of people. This is all emerging in the 1920s in a way that is truly going to transform the world that we live in. And you would recognize, I think, the ads of the 1920s, the come-ons of the 1920s, much more than you would those of earlier ages.
There isn't a lot of dialogue in the book, but there sure is a lot of, okay, this happened, and then this happened, and that's not a coincidence if you look at that. How did you keep all the details straight?
It wasn't very easy. Computers help a lot now in terms of modern technology. It's really a matter of trying to line things up from A to Z, of telling a linear story, telling a story from start to finish. And it is more or less, very often history now is not told chronologically, but this story really lent itself. It had as I like to say, a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this one had a wonderful beginning with his arrival and his early successes at Santa Fe Springs. The middle phase as the company begins to weave its spell and to create the scandal through the overissues, through the pools, and then an ending in which the company collapses, and there are all sorts of court cases, all sorts of, as you mentioned, assassinations, murders, suicides, and all organized crime figures, religious figures coming in.
Maybe you could just retell for us the story of the courtroom murder of Motley Flint, and how Robert Shuler played a role in it.
Right. Well, first of all, Robert Shuler is a pioneer radio evangelist. In 1926, when radio was just beginning, he acquired a radio station. Of course, his leading rival in that field in the 1920s in L.A. was Amy Semple McPherson, who had a station since 1923, who was truly the pioneer media evangelist. But Shuler was very different than Amy was. Amy preached goodness and forgiveness, and Shuler was much more a fire and brimstone preacher who preached not just private but public morality and attempted to clean up the politics of Los Angeles. And so his was very much a political radio show as well as a religious show. And he saw in the Julian Petroleum swindle all of the elements that he felt were plaguing Los Angeles, the corrupt bankers, the corrupt politicians, also attacking, he was very anti-Semitic, and he saw there were several Jewish principals, and he attacked them over the radio. And he helped to fuel a post-swindle, a post-crash fervor against the people who had participated in the Julian scandal. One of the people who listened to the show was a fellow named Frank Keaton. And Keaton, in many ways, was a quintessential Southern California figure. He had moved there from the Midwest in the late teens. He had prospered quite a bit, invested in real estate, and made a good deal of money, but then began to invest in the stock market and did not fare as well, and lost a good deal of money as a result of the Julian swindle. He hadn't really invested in Julian stocks, but he did lose money as a result, and of course lost more money when the national stock market crash came in 1929 and became somewhat unbalanced. And he laid the blame on Motley Flint. And in 1930, and he also began listening regularly to Robert Shuler's radio broadcasts and also reading. Shuler had a magazine, a weekly magazine, and pamphlets. He wrote a pamphlet called Julian Thieves, a second pamphlet called Julian Thieves in Politics, in which he attempted to expose what had happened in the Julian swindle. By 1930, Keaton was seriously imbalanced and mentally unbalanced, and he, Motley Flint was testifying in a courtroom trial that involved David Selznick, the great film producer, and Keaton walked into the courtroom and shot Motley Flint right there and assassinated him right in the midst of the trial.
Jules Tigel is a professor of history at San Francisco State University. His latest book is The Great Los Angeles Swindle, Oil, Stocks, and Scandal During the Roaring Twenties, from Oxford University Press. You're listening to The Best of Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Artist Wodehouse is a pianist whose work in studying early player piano roles has led to the unexpected hit CD, Gershwin Plays Gershwin. In something akin to an Elvis sighting, I asked her how it was possible that some 60 years after his death, George Gershwin could still be playing the piano.
Gershwin did make piano rolls, and they were an idiom unto themselves. There were ways of actually capturing the hand playing of an artist in the piano roll technology by attaching little rods, basically, to the key bed, and it would inscribe on a moving piece of paper underneath the artist as they played the piano. But piano rolls could also be edited. You could add more notes to the paper rolls, and so you could create a more rich and exciting texture than one person could lay down by hand. So it was not only a way of capturing live performance, but also it was a compositional medium as well.
You know, that's not unlike what we see today with the technology. First, musician will play into a keyboard, and then they bring it up on their screen.
Absolutely. I mean, there are direct analogies today in many, many ways, in more ways than I had even thought when we started.
Now, let's go back to this sort of golden age of the player piano. And this is a really fond memory for me. When I was a kid, my grandmother used to go up to an old farmhouse up in New York, right, upstate New York, mm-hmm, and they had been taking in boarders since who knows when. And in the 20s, I guess, the late teens and the 20s, right, they had all these player pianos. And as a kid, I would go up there, and here was these old rolls, mm-hmm, many of which were Gershwin. I called my mother.
Yes, really? You did? You've got Gershwin rolls?
Got
oh,
Gershwin.
Wow.
Well, I don't have them, but I used to play them. And the most popular ones didn't have the starter set up because they'd been used. And
oh, you mean the
scattered
roll leader, yes, of
the
course.
The roll leader.
Ripped.
Right, and I remember that there were holes in all the paper coming in, and as they went by, they would also have the words to the song.
Yes, they would.
Buffalo Gals, Can You Come Out Tonight, leaps to mind. Were these just notes that were on there? Is that all there was?
Well, the holes in the rolls triggered the keys to play, and it was used. The energy source was actually a bellows. It was all by air-driven energy, and there was pneumatic tubing and a quite complex mechanism actually for its day. And when the roll when the holes went over the tracker bar, it opened up the suction and it caused the notes to trigger.
Ah, so what we're talking about is all the keys on the piano would be attached to one of these
through
holes.
Tubing. Yes, that's right, and had its own pneumatic pouch. And
so when that was originally created, the first one, the prototype, someone could play and it would punch the holes through.
Well, the reverse process was you would sit at a piano and there were little there was a connector between the keybed as the note would go down and a instrument that would inscribe on a moving piece of paper the note on, note off, actually. And then that paper, which had the little inscriptions of the events of the artist as they played the piano, they made perforations in the inscription, and they had a rough roll to start working with. And that's how they, that was the original way it was made. But let me just stress that that was one way that piano rolls were made. There were other ways. You could just directly cut note perforations into a piece of paper if you knew what you were doing, and you could create a piano roll without recourse to hand playing.
So you knew, if you knew what you were doing, you
yep,
were...
Yep, you could just do it just mechanically.
So tell us about the body of work that represents the piano rolls. How many were there from George Gershwin, and what are they made of?
Yeah, Gershwin recorded approximately 130 piano rolls, of which I think 18 or 20 are of his own tunes. The rest are by other composers, because that's what Gershwin was doing during that early period of his life. He was playing the music of others for, as a song plugger and as a rehearsal pianist and as an accompanist to singers and dancers on vaudeville.
Ultimately, now, these piano rolls have made their way into a CD.
Correct.
Now, tell us the process that you took starting.
Well, of course, what I wanted to do as a scholar was to find the so-called authentic way of performing these rolls, and I auditioned many player pianos across the country looking for the ideal instruments, and as any fool could tell you, there's no such thing as authentic. They're authentics. There are many different ways that could have been possible during that time, ranging from very poor renditions where there was no dynamics added, and that's authentic, too. So, in other words, I found out that there was no one correct way to do it. So, and the other thing that I found out was that the disrepair of many of these instruments across the country was very severe. And even with the ones that were in fine condition, for us to fine-tune them and to bring them into the recording place that we had set out in New York was almost prohibitive because of the danger to the instruments and because of the vagaries of the adjustments. Really, that was it. So at that time, this whole new range of technologies became available, and I mean literally, as I was going around the country, these things were evolving, unbeknownst to me, actually, in many respects. And when I finally did find out that there are ways of taking the original rolls and converting them to a floppy disk format where we could actually have them played back as they had been played back originally, and in some cases, of course, we could enhance them and therefore create a fine product for the recording when we would actually sit down and play the things for the microphone. That was so appealing to have that kind of artistic control that I decided this was the way we should go.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Artis Wodehouse, a Gershwin scholar. She's received a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to study the player piano rolls of George Gershwin. You started with some player pianos, and you started with some piano rolls.
Right.
How did you move to the newer technology?
Well, piano rolls are just information, just like any other medium. It shows you when the notes turn on and when they turn off in time. And then, in certain cases, the reproducing rolls, it triggers the note velocity. In other words, how fast the hammer travels to the string. And that determines the loudness or softness of the note. The faster a hammer goes to the string, the louder it's going to be. And so that was all the information that was on the rolls.
Now, how did it say how fast it went?
Well, they developed a coding that was also triggered by pneumatics that tripped the hammer to travel at a certain speed. And, I mean, it was very ingenious. It was a binary coding system. It apparently apparently has only ostensibly 16 levels, but actually it has many, many more intermediary levels than that. And another factor that you had to figure into the coding, if you were coding the rolls, was how many notes were being sounded at once, because of course it would bleed off the energy source real fast if you had a lot of notes simultaneously sounding than if you had only two or three. So at the same level, say level 5, if three notes were sounding, they'd be much louder than 15 notes sounding at level 5.
You know, it is interesting, and it's not hard to conceive that if the square that was open, that the air was coming through, was small, yeah, it would be higher pressure, and so
yes,
the hammer would travel faster.
That's right.
And if it was wider, there would be lesser pressure.
Well, actually, those holes were more or less standardized. Certainly the tracker bars were at that time.
Uh-huh.
So there was a certain amount of standardization that occurred around, I guess it was about 1908 or 9, I'm not quite sure, where it was like IBM and Apple sort of merged. So by the time Gershwin was making piano rolls, there was a lot of standardization.
So how did you get the information off the piano rolls?
Well, part of the problem or part of the challenge of this was that Gershwin made several types of rolls, but they fell into two different categories. The first were what were called the 88-note rolls, and these were simply rolls that had the information about the notes and the rhythms. The note came on and the note came off at a certain point in time. There was no dynamics assigned to the notes. In other words, the loud and the soft that makes interpretation, that makes the humanity of any performance, was not there on the roll. So what we did was, well, what I did was I purchased a pianola push-up, which was a predecessor of the player piano. It's a machine. It was built in 1911, and it was being manufactured during the time Gershwin was making piano rolls, but it was then not the way that it was done in most homes. But what a pianola push-up does is that it's a big sort of coffin-like affair that rolls up to any standard piano and has 88 fingers that are made of metal and they are felt-tipped. And you insert your piano roll right in the center and you sit in front of the pianola, which is sitting in front of the piano. So you're sitting in front, sitting in front, and there's the piano. And you foot pump just like what the player piano does. It works on the same identical principle as the player piano. It's all pneumatics and bellows. And the fingers play. And they play the roll, and they play it into a piano.
Oh, right on top of
on top of the keys. You know, it's a really neat instrument, but very bulky, difficult to get adjusted right over the keys. And you can see, you know, it weighs about 200 pounds. You can see why it was superseded by the interplaying player piano, because the companies realized around, you know, 1900 that this was just not going to do, and they could sell more pianos anyway by installing that mechanical apparatus inside of a piano rather than having it sitting outside. So but luckily they did make something like this for our purposes, because we were able to roll that instrument, the pianola push-up, in front of a disclavier. Now, the disclavier is a regular acoustic piano manufactured by Yamaha that's been fitted with a computer, and this computer can record your own hand playing. In other words, if you sat down and played your own tune and pressed the record button, it would play back just as you played. And it can also accept data from other instruments or, you know, from other discclaviers or what have you, music that was actually manufactured quite mechanically inside computers, and it will play back also. So what the disclavier does is it records and can play back. And so it's a kind of an updated player piano, but that record function, it makes it more desirable than the old player pianos, which could only play back from piano rolls. So what we did was we rolled the pianola up to this disclavier, and the fingers centered over the keys. We recorded the roll, me foot pumping the roll, and you press the playback button, and voila, you have the roll recording. And that's how we did those 88-note rolls. Now, the pianola push-up also, in addition to being able to play back the rolls, you can add dynamics. You can add loud and soft. You can add pedaling. You can add accents. And this is what I did playing the pianola. I followed the dynamic line that was printed on the original roll. But of course, I added many of my own ideas, because the dynamic line was very rudimentary, and certainly Gershwin would have never played that way. So I was able to add interactively. It was a very interactive medium. In fact, the whole player piano era, most player pianos were this type. In other words, you sat down there, you foot pumped, and by your foot pumping skill and using the little levers and knobs that were always on the player piano, you could develop your own interpretation. And that was part of the aesthetic of that period.
So it's artists playing Gershwin playing Gershwin.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the things that I'm running up against is people are saying, well, it's not Gershwin, but no way, unless I was an idiot savant being inspired by Gershwin, could I ever play like Gershwin, and nobody can do exactly as Gershwin living today. And even Gershwin, when he played always the same piece different ways. So there's no, again, coming back to standardization, this is performance, ladies and gentlemen. This is not something cast in granite out in the desert. And the thing that does give me, I hope, some credibility is that I actually transcribed Gershwin's disc recording, his 78 disc recordings, which he made in 1926 and 28 for Columbia, where I sat there for thousands of hours and listened to Gershwin. So ostensibly, I should know something about the Gershwin style, and I'm not promoting myself as such, but that was one of the reasons they asked me to do the project.
Well, a lot of times in technology and in science, people say, well, you can't do it perfectly, so it's not any good. And it's like, hey, you're 90% of the way there, 95% of the way there, if you have that base information. And then moving it ahead, it's like, well, it's better than nothing.
Well, I think that there will never be 100%. We will never even know what percent is right, because there's no way to tell how Gershwin would have played some of these earlier roles.
The information's gone.
It's gone. It's just gone. So what? They are like scores. Gershwin wrote An American in Paris. We don't really know how he would have performed it, because there are no recordings of him conducting an orchestra. There's no recording of him conducting the Cuban Overture. There are just little dribs and drabs of some of the other things. So we don't really know. We can never know how he wanted these things. And moreover, if he wanted them a certain way, he would have changed his mind from time to time. That's part of performance. It's a plastic, evolving art.
Well, we have a disc clavier here today. Artist, can you play something for us?
Yeah, I'd like to start with Swanee. This was Gershwin's role of 1920. It was his first hit tune that sold 1 million copies.
Gosh, as I look at it play, it looks like Gershwin must have had 15 hands.
Well, this is actually not true for this selection. I chose this selection because, first of all, it's loud. It's very exciting. But also, it's as Gershwin would actually hand play. He had a very thick, very full, very orchestral hand-played style. And I could sit down and hand play this selection identically to Gershwin, because I've created scores from this material. The Swanee role is pretty much based in his hand playing. That's the way he hand played. And if you hear his 78 disc, you'll hear the same very full, very thick style.
So you say you can play this directly.
Well, I hope so, but I haven't been practicing recently because I've been working on the publicity for this project. But yeah, I'll try it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that was great.
Well, it's not as good as Gershwin, but it gives you the idea of what it was like to actually, how he actually played.
It's almost like he was here.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing that amazes me is that I think some people may not have heard of a Yamaha discclavier. This is not an unusual instrument that was created just for this research. I realized that Yamaha, first of all, many people don't know this, is the largest manufacturer of grand pianos today. And the discclaviers represents 8% of all the pianos sold worldwide.
Yeah.
It's an amazing instrument. So it says to me that there's a lot of these out there, almost like the player piano of today. Can I get a floppy disk with this on it?
Well, yes, I think we will be having it coming out pretty soon. I think probably March this month for discclavier owners.
Right. Now, your editing of these pieces, did you do them on the pianola push-up or did you do them on the Yamaha?
Well, the pianola push-up was sort of our base source for how I wanted the interpretation to go, but because we had the blandishment of being able to edit them a little bit more to make them more refined artistically, you know, you can take the data, put it in a computer, and you can move the notes around, you can adjust some note velocities so that it's more musically apt. And we did definitely do some of that with the ones that I pianolized. But I should mention that there's a second type of roll that Gershwin made, which had those automatic dynamics coated on the side. So I didn't play those on the pianola. They were read by Richard Tonneson's roll reader. And then Richard Brandel, both of these guys live in Texas, created a program that took the information stored in Richard Tonneson's computer and basically converted the information on the roll to a format that could be accepted by the
floppy disk. On the Yamaha.
Yes, that's right. And so it was basically, he created a simulator. You know, Richard Brandel created a simulator of what the old DuoArt reproducing mechanism could do. And one of the advantages of this was that, you know, if we had used an original DuoArt player, because they're made of leather and wood and felt, they are subject to a lot of vagaries from the climate, you know, from
age and humidity.
There's so many
and
things.
Yeah.
So when we did our computer conversion, anytime it was level 6 with 5 notes sounding with this theming being in a certain position, it was always going to come out that way. And rather than hitting a moving target, it was going to be hit always on the target.
So they optically scanned, I'm assuming.
Actually, no, it was a pneumatic scanner he used, but it was he used an old reproducing piano or player piano tracker bar, ran the roll over very slowly, and electrodes were connected to each one of the holes that, as it read, it went across the hole. It was attached into his computer, and he created a visual image of the roll in his computer that looks like the roll. And it was Brandel who took that visual image and created the program.
What an act of preservation all this is.
Yeah. The reason Tonneson created this roll reader was to store information for rolls that he recuts. He has a recutting operation called Custom Music Rolls, and that's where it started. And then Brandel realized if it was stored in the computer, he could create a program to read the dynamics for the reproducing rolls.
So we know once you have the digital data, it doesn't deteriorate.
No. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Artis Wodehouse. She's a pianist and a music scholar who's used technology to bring George Gershwin's own performance, as reflected in early piano rolls, to a CD. Gershwin Plays Gershwin has topped the Billboard charts. How did you decide what to put on the CD?
Well, we recorded 65 of Gershwin's rolls. I forced them to do this. I would say I forced them. They wanted to do that. But of those, we chose 12 for the first release that were Gershwin playing his own tunes. Plus, we put An American in Paris on, which is not Gershwin's role, but was made by his role editor. So there's an historic link to Gershwin anyway. We wanted to put these ones to really show what he did that was his own materials. But believe me, the stuff that we haven't released is just fabulous as well. There's still some more of his own tunes to come, and many, many, many others of composers who are his contemporaries that he made these unique piano roll arrangements.
So we're going to see more CDs.
Yes, yes, at least 2 more.
Were there any differences, you know, from the ones they used the push-up for versus the other technology?
Yes, there were significant differences. And with the roles that I use the pianola for, I think they have more of the vagary of human performance because they're not rhythmically as accurate as the ones that are the automatically coded, because I had to constantly ride the tempo lever, because when you would make a louder sound, it would make the governor move a little faster, move the roll ahead a little faster. It was never a perfect governor. So I always had to pull the tempo back to adjust to this. And so there's a little bit of shifting around in the rhythm. The duo arts, the ones that had the reproducing dynamics in them that were automatic, they were what you call quantized. The beats, the distances between the beats and the measure were identical. They were like metronomic. Now, the editors got around that by slightly delaying and advancing note attacks. But nevertheless, underlying is a metronomic beat. Now, that was a necessity in many cases for the instrument to realize optimally. But that was the style that they did for the dance roles, the up-tempo pieces that were the reproducing pieces. They definitely quantized beats. Actually, the 88-note rolls were also, most of them were quantized as well. But just because you're interactively using this Rube Goldberg affair, the pianola, it's never as precise. But on the other hand, it gives you the chance to be more fluid rhythmically. So it was both a blessing and a curse. And so I wanted to play Idle Dreams, which is one of those that I pianolized. That is a rhythmic piece, but has a little bit the flux of human performance.
Okay. Now, I am a Gershwin fan, and I'm going to name some tunes. Name that tune. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can tell me if they're on the piano rolls. I have to say, now I'm going to give myself away as a real romantic here. So when yes. You hear this one, how about A Foggy Day in London Town?
No, that was a 30s piece. By that time, he had stopped making piano rolls long since.
These are probably all 30s plays.
Well, let's hear your list.
All right. Our Love Is Here to Stay.
Forget it. No.
Someday He'll Come Along, The Man I Love.
The Man I Love, no.
Someone to Watch Over Me. You like that?
No.
None
I'm
of
sorry.
These.
Yeah, it's interesting. The ones that are on the disc that was just released are the most famous ones. And they were Sweet and Low Down, That Certain Feeling.
An American in Paris.
American in Paris and Rhapsody in Blue. I think those are the top famous ones. The other ones are Scandal Walk, you never heard of it, Idle Dreams. But Idle Dreams is charming. Swanee's on.
Swanee.
Course, obviously, we just played that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a big question as to why Gershwin didn't make more roles of his own materials, and it's just too bad he didn't.
Artist, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today has been Artis Wodehouse, a music scholar. Her first CD, Gershwin Plays Gershwin, The Piano Rolls, is available from Elektra. We'd also like to thank the Gary Leuenberger Company in San Francisco for providing the Yamaha Disc Lavier Piano, which you hear throughout this program. Could you play us one more?
I'd like to play one of the duo art, the reproducing numbers that were the quantized beats, but it's a wonderful example of a duo art roll.
Terrific. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Billions and Billions.
Does your brain go on overload when you hear large numbers like an annual budget deficit of $3 billion or a galaxy containing a trillion stars? Mine sure does. One way to get a feeling for very large numbers is to translate them into seconds. There are, for instance, just over a million seconds in 12 days. So to grasp a million, I try to remember what I was doing 12 days ago and imagine that I started counting then. 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. I'd have passed the million mark a few hours ago. How about a billion? That is 1,000 million. Well, that's nearly 32 years worth of seconds. Counting in seconds, you celebrate your 1 billionth birthday a few months before your actual 32nd birthday. A trillion? That is, a million million, gets tricky. In an effort to bring the idea of a trillion down to Earth, I was writing a column about that trillion-star galaxy, I pointed out that the human brain contains about 1/100th as many neurons. A concerned reader wrote, "Dear Barry, I counted the neurons in my brain, and there weren't nearly as many as you said. It makes me wonder if the rest of your information is right." Here's a humbling large number statistic. The genetic code we each carry in every cell of our bodies, our genome, contains about 3 billion pairs of nucleotide bases, each of which can assume one of four forms. Well, this translates into about 750 megabytes of information, which is about the same as that on a single compact disc. Look at a CD, the backside from the label, where all the information is encoded. That's all of your physical being you could be looking at. Of course, our cells store that information much more efficiently in our DNA. How much more efficiently? At least, well, a zillion times more. A zillion. Now that's something else.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.